last few days and lying in bed, feverish and with relatively newly digested food coming out one end and relatively longer digested food coming out the other, gives ample chance for a bit of reflection. and the arising of forms of dispassion, which are not always of the most wholesome sort. And I've been thinking a little bit about the five aggregates, and particularly relationship to some discussions I was having just before I went in, before I got sick. And the interesting thing about being ill is, you know, you can see that the five aggregates, the form, the physical body is, well, it's manifesting dukkha in fairly obvious ways, and feelings are largely unpleasant, perceptions also kind of not particularly, you know, difficult to keep kind of wholesome and positive perceptions going. And sankharas pretty much gets undermined when you're sick. You can't really do anything or plan anything. The mind just sort of retreats from any ability to make powerful or meaningful decisions or choices. And so the only khanda that's left really to cling on to is this ever shrinking little nugget of vijnana, consciousness, that sits in the middle. And somehow, despite all the evidence, and despite all the things that the Buddha said about vijnana, or consciousness, is it's still quite hard to see the suffering or the dukkha in vijnana, in consciousness. I'm not talking, of course, about the fact that consciousness experiences dukkha, which is an entirely different thing. Of course, vijnana knows suffering, it knows painful feelings, just as it knows pleasant feelings. It's quite a distinct matter. But with the nature of vijnana as suffering itself is something which is much more subtle. So this is something I'd like to talk a little bit about this evening, and particularly I'd like to talk about it in the context of kind of teaching which we hear very, very commonly, which is that somehow, to put it kind of baldly or blatantly, that nibbana, or the final goal of spiritual life, is a form of refined vijnana, or a form of refined consciousness or citta, or mind, or something like that. Of course, this particular teaching takes any number of forms. It is, of course, the mainstream teaching in many forms of Hinduism, and perhaps, although this is somewhat more controversial, perhaps also in some forms of Yogacara Buddhism, which we might be looking at a bit more over the next few weeks. It's also generally assumed that this is not the mainstream teaching in early Buddhism, although there have been many persistent attempts to try to establish some kind of consciousness as being Nibbana according to the early suttas. So what I want to talk a little bit about this evening is about what actually vijnana is, and why it isn't and can't ever be nibbana. The basic thing here, the basic problem, is that according to the Buddha, vijnana is always conditioned. Sakuncha paticca rupecha upajati jaku vijnanam. Dependent on the eye and forms arise I consciousness, a very fundamental teaching. Similarly, dependent on the ear and sounds, dependent on the nose and smells, the tongue and tastes, the body and touches, dependent on the mind and objects arises mind consciousness. Which is, of course, the important one for this purpose, because nobody tries to say that eye consciousness is nirvana, but some kind of purely mental consciousness, one presumes, is what is meant. But in each case, there's this idea that vijnana arises in condition. Now, when the Buddha was pointing to this, he wasn't making an assertion. He was trying to point to experience. It's a guide to how to do insight meditation. Cakuncha paticca rupeccha upajati jaku vijnana. Dependent on the eye and forms arises eye consciousness. So this is something for us to investigate, and which we actually can directly investigate in our meditation. You know, reflect on the eye and become aware of the eye. You can use your perception, your imagination, to feel where the eye is, what it is. Get your mind inside it. Knowing what the eye is from the inside, what it feels like, what it's made of. And when we can get in touch and get in contact, get close to the eye in this way by a repeated reflection and perception, we can then see what happens when forms come into the range of the eye. And when a sight comes in, a sight, of course, a rupa is just light. That's all it is. Rupa is just light of different wavelengths, field of light. It's not, rupa is not a thing. You don't see a cave or a person or a tree. You just see light. All of those other things are ideas which the mind puts onto it. So the rupa is just light. So inside is the eye, outside is the light. And dependent on those two things is the eye consciousness. If you didn't have an eye, would there be any eye consciousness, visual consciousness? Well, of course not. If you didn't have any light, if you're in a place of complete blackness, would there be any visual consciousness? Oh, of course not. So these two things arise in dependence on each other. And consciousness arises together with them, not without them. Like visual consciousness. And we can't... It doesn't make sense. Well, the point about this analysis is that it's not just a contingent analysis. It's not just merely that it happens to be the case that like visual consciousness arises dependent on these things. Okay, it's not like, you know, if you buy tomato soup, it's also Campbell's tomato soup, because that's what it just happens to be, that the supermarket has Campbell's soup and doesn't have Heinz soup. It's not a contingent relationship like that. It's a necessary relationship. Without some light, it doesn't make sense to talk about visual awareness, visual consciousness. It just doesn't make sense. It can't happen. And similarly, without the eye, or without something eye-like. So of course today we can imagine that, you know, you can use a camera or some other kind of something else that's photosensitive to play that part. That's fine. That's just a different kind of eye. But there has to be something which, at the most basic physical level, the light waves hit. Light waves have to actually have to impact something in order to register and in order for there to be visual consciousness. And it's that thing which the light waves impact, and that impact is called papigaha, papigaha sampasa in Pali. And this is in the Abhidhamma tradition, they actually might make it much more refined rather than just the eye as a whole. They just say it's the sensitive matter. The pasada, the chakupasada, is this sensitive matter in the base of the eye, which of course in when we were in high school we learnt in biology was what they call the rods and the cones, which are the actual sensitive material that registers the light. So this is, without these two things, eye consciousness simply doesn't happen. So you can imagine if someone's born without eyes and without anything else that would perform or substitute for an eye, is what we call blind. They don't have any visual consciousness. Or alternatively, somebody who was born in a world that was completely dark, where there wasn't any light at all of any kind. And again, there would be no visual consciousness. And so the same kind of reasoning applies with all of the different kinds of consciousness, including mind consciousness. And again, this is not meant as a kind of a dogmatic assertion. It's meant as a framework for contemplation, a framework for meditative inquiry. You take up these formulas, these frameworks, and use them in your meditation to reflect on the nature of these things. Of course, when it comes to the mind, it's a bit different though, isn't it? Because the mind objects aren't external to us in quite the same sense that light is external to us. We can easily imagine, and not just imagine, but actually build a device that will substitute for the eye. We call that a camera. Or a device that will substitute for the ear. We call that a microphone. But we can't really imagine what it would be like to build a device that would substitute for the mind. And we know that in IT they've been trying to build intelligent computers for a long time, and basically it's been a complete failure. Even the most basic test for intelligence, the Turing test, has been a complete failure. No computer's been able to pass it. And there's a new project to try to build a model of the human brain, and they say that in order to model the human brain, each neuron requires the processing power of an average personal computer.